listening to music like that, music that is full of beauty and harmony, doesn't seem like a transition to talking about conflict. But of course, there's a lot of conflict in music, melodies that clash with each other, chords that need resolving. And we're joined today by someone who can help us resolve conflicts, resident psychologist Bruce Leese. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. What a great transition. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to shift gears. It's so peaceful. It reaches us at such a visceral level.
Doesn't
music
it,
like that. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's very powerful stuff. But certainly something else that's powerful in society is conflict. It's hard to imagine a world without conflict. And that's what we're going to talk about today, talk about some of the underlying causes, some of what the true nature of conflict is, and, of course, what we can do about it. So let's start with this, Bruce. What is conflict exactly?
Well, conflict is always a discrepancy between wants and needs and values and desires and all that stuff. It's a discrepancy. It's where one part of you wants one thing and the other part of you wants another thing, or where you want something and somebody else doesn't want you to have something. So at the root of it is a disagreement, but it's different from a disagreement. A conflict has the added dimension of threat. So in a parent-child relationship, the parent says, you can't go out tonight, and the child feels threatened that, you know, they'll lose their relationships. Or at work, a manager will micromanage, and the employee will feel threatened, like they don't have their autonomy. So a conflict contains threat and disagreement and a discrepancy.
Do people always know when they are in conflict with someone else?
Oh, that's the problem, is that people don't realize that they're in conflict. They just don't feel good, and they don't acknowledge that they feel good, and they get embroiled in arguing for what they want, or for those who don't argue, for more introverted people, they may just ruminate over it.
Uh-huh.
And identifying it as a conflict. I am in conflict. We are in conflict. That really is a first step to resolving conflict.
And we'll talk some about sort of the different kinds of conflict and the ways that conflict is in common across different types of conflict. But I guess I'm wondering about another kind of conflict we sometimes hear about, which is internal conflict. Is that a real thing? Is that the same when we're talking about conflict, talk about something happening inside a person?
Oh, boy, I woke up to the news that the Pope is resigning, the first Pope to resign in modern times. And I didn't expect to hear that, but of course the first thing I thought was, what kind of internal excruciating struggle mm-hmm. he must have gone through at 85, I believe he is,
mm-hmm.
Believing on one hand, you know, I am the representative of my people. I have something there's a calling I'm supposed to follow, and then having to admit to himself, no, this is something I can't do. So.
Yeah. Is internal conflict like other kinds of conflict in that way, that idea that there's a discrepancy and there's a threat?
In external conflicts where you and I might disagree on something, or, again, a parent and a child, or a community member versus a community member, usually there is a great sense that I think one thing and you think another thing. Because the mind is so complex and there are thoughts that run pretty deep, and then there are the more present everyday thoughts. We don't often know. I guess if I were Freudian, I'd say, you know, sometimes the unconscious battles the conscious. You know, I want this, but I'm not supposed to have it. So much of that is invisible that we often don't even know it's happening.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR, streaming online at kcur.org. We're talking today with Dr. Bruce Leese, our resident psychologist, about conflict. So Bruce, what is the cause of conflict? Where does it come from?
Well, it's inevitable. It comes from nature as much as anything else comes from nature. Because so much of the human existence is subjective. Because there are so few things we know for sure, there's bound to be disagreement. So the existence of God is a faith issue. And as long as something is a faith issue, people can argue it. The existence of a good versus a bad manager. Oh, and probably one of the most salient conflicts that we know of right now is the conflict between parties in government.
Sure.
Leaders.
So if conflict comes from nature, then I guess I'm led to ask, is it a bad thing? Or is it a good – is it either bad or good?
Well, as long as we stay focused on ideas we don't reject people or our relationships with them, conflict can be a good thing. Without conflict, there's really no growth. A lot of times people will make profound changes in their lives because of a conflict, because of a crisis.
Can you give me an example? Like, when is a time where conflict becomes a good thing?
Well, when two people who are, for example, parents, when a mother and father, or even a parent and a step-parent disagree on how to raise a child, when they listen to each other and when they adapt and when they modify and when they grow from the disagreement, it's a great thing. Being in a two-party political system, when either party swings too far in one direction, it's really important to swing back closer to the middle.
So when does conflict then cross that line from being good, healthy, something that encourages progress and the full consideration of varying ideas? When does it cross the line to being bad?
An extreme example is terrorism. Mm-hmm. When people forget about the issue and they just hate people, other people, enough to destroy them, conflict has gone bad. When two people who previously cared about each other, could be two friends who see the political world differently, destroy the friendship because they can't argue ideas. They end up hurting each other. Then it's turned bad.
It's interesting. We're swinging back and forth between terrorism and the world stage and two friends who are having a disagreement. Are the causes of conflict different on an individual level, on a sort of a small scale level, than they are when it occurs between communities or between nations?
In the obvious ways, yes. In the more subtle ways, no. Whether it's two nations at war or two friends who aren't talking to each other, it's because they have given up on listening to each other, given up on caring for each other, given up on negotiating, given up on empathy. So there are more important similarities, I think, than differences.
I want to invite our listeners to the conversation. We're going to talk about how to resolve conflict today, as well as about the nature of conflict. If you've got experience with conflict, and who doesn't really, we would love for you to share with us about how you resolved it or why you couldn't resolve it. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Bruce Leese, there's different places where conflicts occur. We've mentioned some of those already. I realize, though, that there's almost no context where conflict doesn't occur. Why is it so pervasive? Why is conflict so central to almost every part of life?
Well, fortunately, we all get to control our own minds. And fortunately, we don't get to control anyone else's mind. And so as long as we humans get to think independently, we will clash. And there's no other way of saying that. I appreciated your question to the community: have you had a conflict that you have resolved? Resolution of a conflict can be a major turning point in a person's life. It can be the point at which they finally realize something they never knew before. It can be a conflict that's not resolved festers and eats away at a person, while a conflict that's resolved can change two people's lives. Some of the closest relationships occur only after the resolution of a conflict. So I love your question. I'd be surprised if it didn't get people thinking about conflicts that they have resolved or not resolved.
So again, if it's getting you thinking and you want to share, without airing too many grievances on the air, conflicts that you've resolved or have not been resolved, 816-235-2888 is the number. Let's talk about one particular area where conflicts often happen, and that's in friendships. Friends seem to be in conflict a lot. In fact, sometimes it's the closest friendships that seem to have the deepest or most hurtful conflicts. Why do friends tend to be in conflict with each other?
I can talk personally about this without revealing anything that'll get me in trouble. I have had a close friend, and during this heated political season in our times, it came to my attention that that person, and this was a good friend, that this person was fairly insensitive to other people's feelings who didn't share his political view, and he caused a lot of pain. And I'm not angry at him. I'm not. It's nothing like that. But it's hard for me to forget that that person has turned on people who are innocent and really cut them down. So we hold our friendship, our friends, to high standards. If a stranger, well, I see strangers cut each other down all the time, and it doesn't eat me up inside. Mm-hmm. But when you care about people, you're most vulnerable to being hurt, and therefore conflict can be more acute and painful.
Is there something about entering into a friendship that makes you more vulnerable? Is there something in the psyche that says, go ahead, you can hurt me if you want to, in a way that other people can't?
Oh, yeah. You know, there are these different levels of disclosure, and I'll bring this all back to conflict. There are different levels of disclosure we engage in society. Some people have claimed there are four levels. I've lost count. But on a very superficial level, I can disclose to you, you know, the way I drove to the studio today. That's pretty superficial. On a deeper level, I can tell you how I feel about that drive to the studio today. That's a little bit more openness, makes me a little bit more vulnerable if I say, boy, I was really angry on the way over, which I wasn't. But so that opens me up to your judging me. Then at a deeper level, I can say, Brian, I've always admired you, your work. You're a good guy. I like what you do. And then I'm really open to you saying, you know, I don't like you that much. So that would be a much more painful conflict than if you were a stranger. And then at the deepest level, if I say, you know, our relationship means a lot to me, if I open up that much and you say, well, it doesn't mean a lot to me, I don't particularly like friends. That's why when you go to hug somebody you've never hugged before, to go, oh, it's great to see you, and they just freeze up, it feels bad. That creates a conflict. Like, should I have done that or not?
When you've approached a different level of vulnerability.
Vulnerability, depth, closeness, caring, all those things.
I noticed that, you know, on Facebook, we use the word friends loosely these days, particularly in social media, but you know, that's a place where often there are misunderstandings and conflicts, where grievances get aired. And often that's between different overlapping networks of friends, right, where there's been a different set of expectations with different people.
Oh, boy, yes. I'm on Facebook because we have a business that kind of needs to be on Facebook. So I do see what goes on there. And I'd be scared to death to put down things that really matter to me in the world on Facebook, because I see so often that people, that lack of you know, physical closeness, that the electronic medium just makes it easy to say things that can be hurtful things. So there's a lot of potential for conflict, lots of potential. I saw some postings on my wall the other day, and one of them was anti this, and the other one was pro this, the same thing, and then the other one was anti this. It's just amazing how much conflict goes on.
So if we broaden the conversation beyond just friendships, sort of personal relationships, a place where there's a lot of conflict in many people's lives is at work. And you and I talked a couple months ago about work on this program. We talked about how work becomes a part of people's identity, in part because that's where they spend most of their time. Is that also why it is a source of so much conflict?
Yeah. People spend a lot of time at work. And when you ask somebody out in the public who you're getting to know about themselves, the two areas that they'll talk about are family or love and work. So we are what we do. We really become that. And it makes us vulnerable. And if we are directed in ways that are against our grain, against our values, beliefs, etc., at work, it can be as painful as fighting at home with one's own spouse.
And so you speak of being directed in ways that cause conflict. That's something that happens at work, where often we're in a position where someone can direct us, tell us what to do.
That's exactly right. I was talking to, I've got a little a little shop in Lawrence, and I have people working for me, and they're young people, and you know, at some point they're going to start looking at bigger, brighter horizons, and they may, you know, they may look to corporate America. And I secretly want to warn them, you know, be careful what you ask for. You might get it, because you get so much control in an intimate work environment that you lose as the organization grows bigger and bigger and bigger, and everything's in the handbook, the employee handbook. So, you know, you get a lot more control over how you deal with conflict when it's just a few people in a shop at work.
You mentioned, we've talked a bit, that there is good conflict, that it leads to some positive outcomes sometimes. And in fact, the workplace seems like one of those places. Innovation, progress, the sort of the seeking a competitive edge, or the way that ideas get refined by being brought up against other ideas. Is that right? I mean, is there an especially positive kind of conflict that takes place at work?
I'm chuckling to myself and to you because, you know, I'm in my 50s and I have people working for me in their 20s, and they learned how to do what they do under my tutelage. But before you knew it, they were saying things like, are you sure you want to do it that way? Or have you returned that phone call that you were supposed to return? And it felt jarring initially. And yet now I welcome it and hope for it and need it. So that conflict between what I was ready to do and what they're saying I shouldn't do really helps me to grow as a person and as an employee of my own business.
816-235-2888 is the number to call. 816-235-2888. If you've had conflict in your life that has gone unresolved, we'd love to hear about that, what the consequences of that have been. Georgia in Overland Park called us. Good morning, Georgia.
Good morning. How are you, Brian? It's so nice to hear your voice on this program today.
Thank you. What's your question or comment for Bruce Lee?
Well, I just have a comment. Thank you, Dr. Lee, for being there.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm not a Buddhist, but I have found that I've had conflict. I've gotten angry, and but I find that if you believe, like Buddhists, that life is always changing. It's not about you and your desires and what you want or what your expectation is. Because isn't that what conflicts come out of, is our expectation is awry, that we don't get what we expect there should be. And if you just accept that life is always changing, it's not about you, it's not about what you expect, then conflict is less.
Well, let's ask Bruce Lee about that. Is there a certain amount of conflict that is avoided simply by accepting the changing nature of life?
Absolutely. That gets back to that control thing, Georgia. You mentioned dashed expectations, and earlier I said that conflict is a discrepancy between wants, needs, values, etc. I didn't mention expectations and reality, but that's a real source. It's interesting. All spiritual foundations recommend that we let go of the things we can't control. I agree that that's a major feature of published Buddhist writings, but it's also a big part of all religions.
Georgia, thanks so much for the call.
You're welcome.
We'll continue to talk about conflict when we come back, including conflict in communities, neighborhoods, churches, the homeowners association, all the places in our daily lives where conflict breaks out. If you have some tips of your own for resolving conflicts, whether in the workplace or the community or somewhere else, give us a call at 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. We'll continue this conversation with Dr. Bruce Lease. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. And welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about conflict, what causes it, and how to resolve it. How have you overcome conflict? What were the strategies that worked best? How did you feel after the conflict was resolved? You can share your experiences with us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Bruce Leese is our guest, as always, as we delve into the world of psychology. Bruce, we were talking about places where there's conflict, the workplace, in friendships. A place where a lot of people experience conflict is in communities or organizations, groups of people that in many cases are actually formed specifically to avoid conflict or to promote harmony, but seem to be sources of conflict. Why do groups of people, when they come together, seem to start doing battle with each other?
It's back to those discrepant value systems, those discrepant needs, wants, and desires and goals. As an example, I'm the chair of the Lawrence Douglas County Planning Commission, and we're a quasi-judicial body, meaning we're like judges, but we're not judges. But 10 of us listen to sometimes a developer claiming that a development will be good for everybody, and then a community that says, no, it won't be. And these meetings, these hearings can become very, very, very heated.
Local politics, nothing worse. Right?
And well, it is. It's local politics. It's community action. It's all that stuff. And when that occurs, the conflict is palpable. I mean, you can cut it with a knife. And, the role of the Planning Commission is to try to get consensus and do the right thing and follow the comprehensive plan. But what I love most is when we direct the community. We may defer on a project and direct the community to go, to go back to the drawing board and talk to each other and come up with something that they can both agree on, because they have no idea of what we have no idea whether we're going to vote for or against the project. But there are some very heated, painful discussions that mm-hmm. go on in neighborhoods over things like that.
You know, I'm anecdotally, at least, I'm aware that a lot of the strongest conflicts, the ugliest conflicts, seem to happen in groups like PTA board meetings, or homeowners associations are often a source of great conflict. I wonder if there's any reason why those conflicts are nastier than others.
I love that question. I have spoken to a very good friend who was on a board with me in a neighborhood kind of organization, and I've spoken to clergy who all seem to agree
yes.
that
church councils, yes.
Yes, that volunteer organizations are very. It's the term herding cats may be relevant here, and what I've discussed with people and what they've told me who have more experience than I do with volunteer organizations is that volunteers come into volunteering with a set notion in their mind about what they want to accomplish and what their skill sets are. And everyone wants volunteers. Nobody gets paid to be a volunteer. And so when people make demands or when their feelings are hurt, or it's almost amplified because they're not getting paid. They're volunteering. And they say, how dare you call into question what I think we ought to do? I'm the one who's giving my time for this. But when 2, 3, 4 people are all feeling that way, and they all have different ideas, it can be excruciating too.
Yeah, I wonder. Let me test a theory as well. Do you think that these conflicts are often about power? So often people who come in and they assume leadership on their local homeowners association or maybe a church council, they may be people who don't have a lot of power in their workplace or in their families, but suddenly they have it now in some other setting. Is that part of what causes conflict?
You use the word power, and the answer is yes. That's the simple answer. The more complex answer is that power is a combination of responsibility and authority, say-so, the ability to be autonomous. And people who don't have autonomy in their conventional environments, work, home, etc., might volunteer because they want more. They want more say-so. They want more what you called power, responsibility, etc.
Yeah.
And when they don't get it as a volunteer, just like they don't get it at home or at work, it can cause great internal distress.
Well, so we've done a pretty good job here, I think, Bruce, of raising the problem of conflict. Let's see if we can get to more the solution, to the resolution of conflict. And I wonder if we might start with this question from Rachel in Mississippi. Rachel, good morning. You must be listening online.
Good morning, guys. Actually, no, I'm calling you. No, it's kind of crazy. I was streaming it on my phone, and then I heard you. So in listening to your conversation just now, I have a question, but I'm going to save that till just the end. I wanted to make a few comments. I think a lot of the conflict, too, like what you're talking about in these groups, like PTA, is some sort of assumed homogeny or like a common denominator. People come into this group thinking, oh, you're like me. You're here for the same reason. And then you find out that socially or politically, it's so diverse and, you know, and disparate. And another one is cultural competency. I really think that people, you know, when you're in conflict, I may perceive something that is a threat to me culturally for whatever reason, my identity, my ethnicity, any of those things, my language that I choose to use, my first, my, you know, native language, and that other person doesn't perceive the same threat. So cultural competency, I think, plays into that a lot as well. And as to my question, I'm really interested in alternative dispute resolution, specifically mediation. And I was wondering, a question for you, Doctor, and I can take my answer offline, is what, if any, is the most important sort of tool in your bag of tricks that you see for alternative dispute resolution?
Oh, wow. That was a lot, Rachel. I want to first compliment you before I answer your question. The point about homogeneity is a really good one. People enter into volunteer work because they think they're going to be with a group of people that agrees with them, sees the world the same way, et cetera. And it may be like a bucket of ice water on their head when they realize that the person yeah. across from them is not a Republican or a Democrat. They're the opposite of what they are or uh-huh. whatever. Or they're a Muslim and, oh, my God, you know, I didn't know I'd ever that kind of thing. So and social competency. I'm sure we'll talk about this before the show's over, talk about social intelligence or emotional intelligence. But alternative dispute resolution, your question, what's the most important? There are multiple skills necessary for dispute resolution or mediation. The most important quality a mediator can have is the ability to see both perspectives. I think it was Einstein who said that's the mark of genius, the ability to see opposite points of view simultaneously. So that's number one. Number mm-hmm. two is this social competency that you talk about. When people are upset, they often don't know they're upset. That's why so often when you say to somebody, you're getting angry, they go, no, I'm not angry, as they scream, no, I'm not angry. So, you know, there's an ability to see both sides of an argument, the ability to empathize, and then the ability to be effectively assertive as a mediator to say, no, you can't do that in this mediation. You can't talk like that. You can't act like that. So great points, Rachel. Very good points and great question. Those are just a few of the skills. I hope that's helpful.
Rachel, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you, guys.
She called us at 816-235-2888, and you can too. Has conflict ever turned out to be a good thing for you? Give us a call at 235-2888. Bruce Leese, you were mentioning mediation and the idea that someone else might help parties resolve conflict. If you don't have a mediator, it's just the two of you who are in conflict, you and your supervisor, or you and your partner, or you and the nation across the border, how do you resolve that conflict? What are the keys to coming together?
Well, the key is to think like a mediator. Mm-hmm. See both sides of the argument is number one. Number two, be emotionally intelligent. When the other person stops listening because they're so upset and they're adhering so strongly to their point of view, recognize that and realize that you have to take a different approach. Continue to care for the other person. Be direct and assertive without being confrontive, without being aggressive, without being hostile.
Right. One of the things in premarital counseling I often talked about with couples was that assertiveness is not the same thing as aggressiveness. Assertiveness being able to clearly state what it is you want.
You bring up premarital counseling. I'm delighted to hear that you, Brian Ellison, do that because I think you'd be great at it. I think that couples have the misconception when they first meet that this magical feeling they have will last forever. And I always say to couples, the real test of love, and this is true in friendships, it's true in international relations, the real test, and I mean that, it's true in international relations. We see that in our relationship with Israel. We see that in our relationship with Europe. The real test of a good relationship is how well we resolve conflict. It's how well we get through the tough times. And that's what I focus on when I do premarital counseling. It's like, what have you guys fought about? And if they go, oh, nothing, I say, when are you going to get married?
Right. Right. Maybe too soon, right?
Maybe too soon. Thank you. That's exactly right, Brian.
So a phrase that's sometimes used is conflict averse. There are people who actually seem to always want to avoid conflict. What do you say to someone who is conflict averse?
Well, that's a normal state of being. We don't like when others don't like us. We don't like when others don't like our ideas. So an optimum level of aversion to conflict is normal, an optimum level, not too little, not too much. I recently spoke to somebody who, you know, they were just itching for a fight. I mean, they revealed, you know, people don't like me because I say what I think. That is somebody who likes conflict a little bit too much and may have a real hard time listening to others when their ideas conflict with them. So both ends of that continuum of conflict approach or avoidance are both ends of the continuum are problematic.
And what are the consequences of avoiding conflict? I mean, what's likely to happen later as a result of avoiding
it? Have you heard the phrase doormat? People refer to themselves as doormats when they avoid conflict so much that they feel terribly weak and incapable and inadequate and stepped on, hence the term doormat.
Let's take a call at 816-235-2888 from Becky in Parkville. Becky, good morning.
Good morning. I had called regarding a couple of different issues. The first one was that I was kind of self-reflecting about the use of the term conflict, because if you really think of how it's used in the media these days, we apply it to things that we used to say the word war. We used to talk about war in another country. And now we say we're in a conflict. And I think for a lot of people, the word conflict denotes something much more violent than a simple disagreement.
Interesting. Do you agree with that, Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, at the kind of the peaceful end of a disagreement is what you'd call a disagreement. Somewhere in the middle is conflict, where disagreement comes to the forefront, and then war is where conflict and disagreement leads to violence. I wonder if we avoid the word war for the same reasons we were avoiding, showing bodies coming back from war. I hope that society hates war. If there's anything worth hating, it should be war. And perhaps we are using the term conflict because we don't want to face the fact that we've been at war for too long.
And then something semi-related is the fact that, you know, my children for their preschool years go to a Montessori school. And for a lot of people, they don't realize that founder, Maria Montessori, she started that school foundation because her belief was if you could teach children conflict resolution, they would grow up to be adults who could handle conflict resolution, because she started it during World War. And she was just tired of watching all the adults go to war over things that could have been resolved.
Thank you, Becky, for the call very much. And Becky raises a good point that education can do a lot to help children learn how to resolve conflicts.
Yeah, I understand from our discussions here in the studio that we may be doing a show on the psychological causes and effects of competition in the future. And I only bring that up now because so much emphasis now is placed on children competing at a very young age in sports. And that's not an issue for me, that kids go out and play and swing a bat at a ball and hit home runs and run around the bases and they win this game and lose that game. When we overemphasize competition, we teach, and that's, I want to emphasize the word overemphasize, the word competition, we stop focusing on caring and we start focusing on winning. Mm-hmm. And I believe that it's important to teach people how to be resilient in a competitive environment and by competing as children. But overemphasis on that can be very, very destructive, because the best way to resolve conflict is by caring about people. And it's hard to simultaneously teach highly competitive people in highly competitive activities to also simultaneously care about your competitor. So it's very complex. There's a very interesting psychology there of competition. And from what the caller said about Montessori, I'd never known that. I think that's a great way to base a school on teaching kids how to get along. So,
we had a comment posted by Michael on Facebook. He wrote, "Poor communication often creates conflict. The conflict that arises from an unintended or misplaced word can often be averted if the quote-unquote offended party asks for clarification. That is, your remark did not strike my ear well. Did you mean to say?" Communication, obviously, a frequent source of conflict, but sometimes easily corrected.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have read studies that say that 90% of emotion is conveyed nonverbally by tone of voice, volume of voice. It's not so much the content of what we say, but often how we say it. If our voice if we're high pitched, if we're loud, if we don't stop while we're talking, if we look angry, that all conveys that I don't like you, I don't like what you're saying. So communication problems are highly correlated with unresolved conflict. And my guess is that most of the communication that goes awry is nonverbal, not the words themselves.
Speaking of communication conflicts that are often present, there's an area of conflict that we haven't covered yet, which is family conflicts. In particular, I'm thinking of sibling rivalries or sibling conflicts that sometimes last not for an hour, not for a year, but for 50 years, lifetimes. How do we address conflicts between siblings?
Well, as a clinician, I can't even begin to count how many adults I have seen that are in emotional trouble as adults because of allowed violence at home between them and siblings. If you are the big kid and you're the bully, or if you're the little kid and you're bullied by siblings, it can really wreck your view of the world forever. So how parents deal with those kinds of conflicts between siblings is very important. I like to recommend to parents that they create in their own home a world that kids can expect when they get out of the home. So if you can't scream and pound on your neighbor when their dog is barking, don't let your kid scream and pound on their sibling.
It's not good to sort of toughen them up.
It is worse than not good. I think kids who are perpetually fighting with their siblings, it is not innocent. It is not innocent. So I'm very direct about this matter. I say to people, if your kids are being violent or hostile unkind to each other in really overt ways, you need to put a stop to it. And if you don't know which one started it, it doesn't matter. They both go in timeout. They both have consequences. Mm. Siblings really learned some pretty significant patterns from each other in childhood. And unrestrained fighting as a kid with one sibling can cause lifelong problems.
So that's how parents could address it. How about for adults who these patterns are now well established? Is there any way out of it?
Yeah, forgiveness. that's a phrase we haven't brought up yet. I'm glad that you're giving me the opportunity to do that. It's well established that forgiveness is a path that is well worth taking whenever people suffer in their relationships with other people. Whether you're forgiving your sibling or forgiving a neighbor or forgiving a spouse, forgiveness is an important cognitive process wherein you don't approve of what they did to you, but you let go of your anger, your hate, or whatever. So two adults that haven't talked to each other for 40, 50, 60 years, or 20 or 10 years, they need to forgive each other, especially if they are siblings, because that's a very important relationship.
Before we go, Bruce, let me ask one more question. It's an important one. We've talked about conflict and conflict resolution. I wonder, how do we avoid conflict before it starts? Is there a certain way that people can live their life or look at the world that is likely to lead to less conflict in the first place?
Yes. Take seriously what I think it was Einstein said. The geniuses of the world can see all perspectives, or at least two opposing perspectives on problems. In order to avoid problematic conflict, before you go into a situation where someone's likely to feel strongly or be upset, make sure you see their perspective as well as your own perspective.
And how do you do that? I mean, if I'm...
Empathy. Imagine yourself in their shoes. Walk a mile in their shoes. Don't do anything unto other people that you wouldn't want unto yourself. It's interesting the spiritual angle was brought up earlier, and you could probably tell me, as well as anyone, whether or not that's emphasized across religions, that ability to see the world through the other person's eyes.
Sure, and obviously, as you said, forgiveness is pretty much a part of every religion in the world. It's good to have you here, Bruce. Bruce Leese is our resident psychologist. He joins us from time to time to talk about all sorts of matters affecting us as human beings. Bruce, it's been good to have you here today.
It's always my pleasure and my honor. Thank you so much.
You can find out more about Bruce and more about this topic by visiting our website, kcur.org. We also have archives and podcasts and a lot more on the Central Standard page there. Be sure that you tune in tomorrow for an exploration of various impacts that Walmart has had on our communities. Stay tuned now for Up to Date. They'll be talking about 7 steps to create a remarkable relationship. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. I'm Brian Ellison, and this is Central Standard.